Seems like interest in using native plants in home gardens just continues to grow, and it's no surprise since they have a lot of qualities, good qualities, to recommend them. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along for another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Native plants, especially prairie varieties, are very hardy. We've seen them thrive in some pretty extreme conditions. And they have some specific needs to get started and to really thrive. And lucky for us, we have somebody with us who knows a lot about them. Neil DeBole. Neil from Prairie Nursery comes by a few times a year to talk about how to use native plants and why you should appreciate them. And Neil, always great to have you with us. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Larry. Great to be here again.
Well, it's certainly early in the gardening season, but it makes sense to plan out what we need and want to do once the weather cooperates. And I often hear about burning prairies. Let's just start with burning prairies.
Sure, absolutely. And I would, as I mentioned earlier to you when we were before the show, is that today is the first day of spring in Wisconsin because last night was our last night below zero, so theoretically. So that is officially spring in Wisconsin, which then makes us all think about gardening. And for prairie aficionados and people that do have prairie landscapes, prairie gardens, and prairie meadows, burning is really the best method for encouraging the native flowers and grasses in your prairie, and discouraging a lot of the perennial weeds that invariably find their way into prairies. And the timing of the burning is extremely important because the goal here is to burn after the bad guys have emerged. And the bad guys, by definition, in this case, are cool season grasses and weeds. We have typically problems with quackgrass, Kentucky bluegrass, which is a long grass. It starts growth 4 to 6 weeks prior to most of your prairie plants and can start to take over and get first crack at nutrients, water, etc. The clovers, red clover, white clover, can be problematic. So what we do is we wait for these cool season grasses and weeds to come up while most of your prairie plants, which are predominantly warm season, are still dormant or just beginning to come up. So the timing of the burning is such that you do maximum damage to the cool season plants without doing any or minimal damage to the primarily warm season prairie plants. So the timing is critical. Usually in, let's say, southern Wisconsin, it's between April 15th and April 30th, although the last 2 years it's been even into May because we had such cool and damp springs. But normally it's around the third week of April, fourth week of April. The best way to tell is when the buds of the sugar maple tree are opening up. Because they're always timed with each other. It could be April 15th, it could be May 10th, but it's always going to be consistent with the best time for burning. On a typical prairie, unless you have a dry prairie that has a lot of early blooming flowers, they'll be harmed by this significantly. So either you burn those very early in spring or in the previous fall, usually after mid-October into early November.
We've had several several comments from people over the last month or so from Garden Talk listeners who said, well, I can't burn.
Very good point, yes.
Because of where they are or whatever.
Oh, if you're in the city, usually there are regulations about that. If you're near a wooden home or, vinyl siding, the melting temperature, which is just above warm skin. So there are situations where you can't burn. And a really good alternative to that is mowing the prairie right down to the dirt as close as you can. If you have a lawnmower, set it on the lowest level. You may not be able to take a full whack at it. You may have to take a half a pass at it because of the density of the vegetation. Mow it right down to the earth and then rake that material off to expose the soil. You will be mowing back the early growth of the undesirable cool season weeds and grasses, thus harming them by depriving them of their new growth. And you're exposing the soil to the sun so it warms up, which is another big factor in burning. It turns the soil black.
Yes.
So the soil absorbs the heat of the sun. Studies that I did at the University of Wisconsin in Green Bay many years ago showed on a burn that was done on May 1st, 4 days later, the burn portion was 18 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the unburned portion because the unburned portion was insulated by all the dead plant material. The burn side was exposed, and mowing and raking accomplishes a very similar effect.
You know, I know that you can also burn in some wooded areas. I guess doesn't it depend on the kinds of trees and what?
Yes. Savannas, which are sort of related to prairies. They often have a lot of the same species as prairies in them, are typically dominated by trees with thick bark, like oaks, hickories, black cherries. And these are fairly fire-resistant, in some cases very fire-resistant trees that are adapted to occasional fires that go through them. And a fire that goes through a savanna usually is not as hot. There's not as much fuel because of the vegetation not being as dense as a prairie. So they're not these disastrous fires that kill trees. And most of the trees of that type are able to handle it. And many of the flowers and grasses that occur in savannas are completely adapted to being burned. So it's actually a very good management tool for those types of forests. But burning is not for all forests. Sugar maples, birch, hemlock, most pines, red pine are fairly fire-resistant. White pine aren't terribly fire-resistant, so you can really do some damage if you're burning the wrong kind of forest. So make sure you've got a savanna woods and not like a northern forest woods or something of that ilk.
Neil DeBoer, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Our guest, you can join in at 800-642-1234. We have Bob in Amherst who's been waiting a bit, so let's go to Bob. Hi, thank you for waiting.
Oh, good morning, Neil and Larry. Neil, I'm a little bit of a blast from the past. This goes back to, I think, either the late 70s or early 80s when you had first taken over Prairie Nursery from the Smiths.
Yeah, 1982.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
Anyway, myself and two of my colleagues, we were returning from a conference up in the Arrowhead of Minnesota and looked you up. It was getting toward the latter part of the day, and I think you and your partner, I don't know, you might have been in a trailer. Mark Bader, was that your partner?
Brian Bader, yes.
Brian, okay.
Two guys living in a trailer growing wildflowers and starving to death because nobody wanted to buy native plants.
That was it, exactly. So anyway, we stopped by to get some pointers, and you were very helpful because we were in the midst of, actually, our board of directors for the college, that is Moraine Valley Community College down in Pelos Hills, Illinois.
Oh, sure, yes.
Anyway, they had given us 40 acres to play with, and we ultimately did 2 acres a year for about 20 years.
Have you got a question for us there, Bob?
So anyway, at that time, Harold Rock's Prairie Propagation Handbook was kind of our Bible.
Uh-huh.
And so anyway, we ultimately, in fact, I finished off and retired about 21 years ago, and I'm now living here in rural Amherst, and I have about an acre and a half of prairie around the house.
Okay.
I got a little bit of a problem with black-cap raspberries.
Yes, those can be quite problematic, yes.
And I plan on burning this spring, and I was wondering, do you have a trick for kind of eradicating and getting that out? The patch is getting pretty big.
Well, I wish I had a magic bullet for you on this, Bob. Raspberries, and of all types, black and red, are one of the few species that I have difficulty controlling in my own prairie at my home. And that's because burning doesn't kill them. It removes the canes, the first-year cane, so you will prevent them from producing fruit and thus seeds that could further infest the area, but it will not kill them. They have rhizomes, as I'm sure you've noticed, that creep under the ground and that assist them in forming these large patches, which in some cases can be quite large and quite problematic. They're not really user-friendly. They're great for wildlife, but if your goal is more to have more prairie flowers and grasses, that may trump the wildlife factor. So here's what I do to control or attempt to control raspberries on my property. Burning will help, but only, again, preventing them from producing fruit. I either go out after a rain when the ground is damp with a dandelion digger and dig up the actual clumps and the rhizomes attached to them. This is a completely non-chemical method. It is not 100% effective because you always will leave some rhizomes behind. You'll have to go back and repeat this a number of times in order to eradicate it. If you are a little more aggressive, you can go out in the fall after the leaves have dropped and find the canes and cut them to the base. And you'll see when you cut the canes, there are old canes that are brown and there are new canes that are green. Only the green canes are actively growing. And so what I do is I put concentrated herbicide on those canes. You can use either concentrated glyphosate, such as Roundup, or you can use things like triclopyr which will also kill the roots. But it doesn't kill them all the way because it doesn't transfer all the way into the rhizomes across the entire area. So you will have to do this for a period of probably 2 to 3 years to really get it under control. So that's what I do. I'm not 100% effective. I have reduced the populations, but it's unfortunately one of the really tough ones, and it's an ongoing battle against the raspberries.
Oh, thanks very much, Bob, for calling. I appreciate your call. I want to give Steve in West Allis a chance to join us. Steve, hi to you.
Hi, how are you folks doing today?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Okay, a couple of summers ago, we went up to Spring Green, stayed at a nice bed and breakfast, and they recommended taking a walk around the Wisconsin desert that's nearby. That little sandy area that's got a lot of native cactus, we noticed. So I tried growing some at home, and it didn't work. So are there ones available that are the native ones?
We have two species native to Wisconsin, Opuntia compressa and Opuntia fragilis. Opuntia fragilis is a state-threatened or endangered species, so you can't mess with that without a permit. But Opuntia compressa, which is the water bottle cactus, actually, you know, believe it or not, cactus occur in all 48 states in the lower U.S. There are at least one species per state. The easiest way to grow this is to have a sandbox. And if you have good soil, don't even bother, or bring in a big pile of sand, because the cacti simply will not tolerate poor drainage. You have to have very well-drained, low water-holding capacity, sandy soil. And you can just go out and take one of those pads and put it in the soil, and it will root itself. And a big mistake people make with cacti is they overwater it. Never water it. And when I was a kid, I had a cactus collection of Arizona cacti, and I grew cacti from seed, and they were in my south-facing window in my bedroom, and I watered them about once every 6 months.
Yeah. That's my kind of plant.
So, and you can tell by looking at the ribs on the cacti if they're starting to get like thin, like a dog that hasn't eaten for a while. You can see it on the ribs of the cacti. They start to bend inward, then they're ready for some water. And once they get fat and turgid, then it's time to leave the water off for 4 to 6 months. So first and foremost is your soil.
Pardon me, is there a resource, though, I can get some? Because the ones I got just didn't seem to work, and I had prepped the soil, unless it was still too much soil, not enough sand, but...
You don't want soil, you want sand.
You want no
complete
soil.
Complete sand, no
complete
soil.
Complete sand,
well.
Right.
Probably my mistake.
I bet you, once you've got the right conditions, it's very difficult to kill that stuff. Although, our cacti are subject to winter damage, and this winter is going to be tough on cacti because they didn't have any snow cover. I bet they got pretty whacked cacti. So, they really will only grow in a really poor, dry, sandy soil in our climate. So that's what I would do first, and then you can just stick those pads in there and let them go and make sure never water them.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Neil DeBole, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer today here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this edition of Garden Talk. Visiting today with Neil DeBole. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, Patty Nagai comes back. She's UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County, and she'll talk about what to get done now to get a jump on the growing season. That's next week on Garden Talk. Right now, though, Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery talking about how you can incorporate native plants into your landscape. And certainly looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Reach us on Facebook at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org or post, give us a phone call at 1-800-642-1234. And Tim in Green Bay, excuse me, has a question. Hi, Tim. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. My question is planting prairie grasses on a mound system, is that DNR wise or
good thing, isn't it?
Possible.
Yeah.
In fact, it's recommended because those roots will get down there and start to consume some of that waste moisture and waste nutrients as well. A really good resource on planting a mound system with native prairie is put out by the University of Minnesota, and I bet if you just Google University of Minnesota Landscape and Mountain System with Prairie, it'll come right up. And they have a nice little handbook that you can view online, and it shows you all the different steps. The plant recommendations are not the best for Wisconsin, but what we generally do is we work with species that are matched to your soil, and you want to make sure that you use the right plants. And generally required by law, you have to put topsoil on your mound. So you're looking at a medium-type soil, a mesic soil, what we call medium soil mixes, that will match the soil conditions of that topsoil. But you can put on a big, tall prairie. You can put on a lower-growing short prairie, short meaning 2 to 3 feet, maybe 4 feet tall. Tall prairie, anywhere from 2 to 10 feet, depending upon the species. So you have a lot of different options. Most people opt for a lower-growing choice on their prairie. We put a prairie on our septic system when we put it in 33 years ago, and we just had it replaced with a mound system, not because the septic system failed, but because the tank broke. And when the tank broke, then they have to go and look at your septic system. Our septic system was, they said, as good as the day as it was installed, but the law had changed, and the distance to the water table had been raised by a foot, so we were no longer in compliance, so we had to put a mound system in where our field was perfectly good because, I say, because we planted a prairie over it, and it sucked all the junk out of it. So, but, yes, in fact, a prairie on top of mound systems is an excellent, excellent choice, and it's way better than lawn because it's prettier, it's lower maintenance, and you get all kinds of birds, butterflies, and other pollinators that come to your mound system.
Well, thank you much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call there. And you mentioned pollinators, and that's, I think that's really is one of the great things about native plants is the pollinators it brings.
Pollinators are huge. And, you know, pollinators are just one of those things that we just have always taken for granted. And if you look at the role of pollinators in our food chain for humans, about one-third of the foods that we eat are pollinated by insects and other invertebrates. And remember, also some other pollinators, some very cool pollinators. The hummingbird is a pollinator.
Yeah.
So all these different wonderful organisms that come to our native plants, and there's an extremely strong connection between native plants and native pollinators. In fact, we're working with farmers, especially cranberry farmers. They need pollinators in their cranberry bogs for about 3 weeks when the cranberries are blooming. So they find in some cases where they just have bogs and nothing around it, they don't have the populations of pollinators. So what they're doing is planting strips of prairie in between the bogs so that they have pollinators all year long. So when it's time for them to have their cranberries pollinated, they have resident pollinators there available. More and more farmers are doing this because they have to. We've taken away so much of the natural habitat that now we're forced to really restore it so we have a good balance of pollinators.
And that would be aesthetically very pleasing, as you know, along with all the rest of the good things about having those native plants in there among those beds.
Oh, and just look at some of the cool things that come to your...
Yeah.
And here's... You know, we always think of butterflies and birds. These are great things to bring to your prairie, and they do. They come in droves. But here's something we don't appreciate are the things like wasps. Okay, especially the parasitic wasps. As E.O. Wilson at Harvard University says, the eminent entomologist, the insects, especially the wasps, are the little things that keep everything in control. And there's a parasite for almost every bad bug and also for good bugs. But you have problems with pests in your garden, the best thing you can do is plant a prairie with lots of flowers in it, and that will attract all these parasitic wasps that in most cases will really help to control the problems in your food garden. And there's other organisms also, good beneficial insects that will be attracted, and the supporting habitat around your food garden will then be available to work in your garden for you.
And I'm seeing that there's more renewed interest in trying to develop plantings specifically for monarchs, because the monarch population seem to be going down, and you can do that, can't you?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've always had nice butterfly mixes, but last year we created some monarch seed mixes and monarch plant gardens that specifically contain members of the milkweed family. And because, of course, the monarch butterfly caterpillars rely entirely upon members of the milkweed family, so we really cranked up the milkweed percentages in these gardens and in these seed mixes so people can now, on their own property, create monarch habitat. And there's a great program called Monarch Way Stations. And so you can Google this, too. Just look at Monarch Way Stations. And the whole concept of this program is to create refugia for monarchs as they migrate between Mexico and North America and northern United States and back, but also to create summer habitat because there are like three flights during the year of monarchs, different generations. And so you really need to have not just the monarch food plants for the caterpillars in the form of the milkweed plants, but also all those nectar plants that are also associated with the prairie flowers to support the adults.
And you have that in a mix.
Yeah, we have a monarch mix for clay soil, kind of heavy soil, clay soil, medium soil, and monarch mixes for dry sandy soils. And then we have gardens that are pre-designed where you get a whole set of plants that comes with a design, and you just plug them into your garden.
You, if I remember, you recommend Doug Talmy's.
Oh, yes.
Book, do you not?
What a fantastic resource. If you want to learn about the relationships between our native plants and insects, read Doug Talamy's book. That's T-A-L-L-A-M-Y. The book is called Bringing Nature Home. And it is a phenomenal, groundbreaking book. We all kind of knew that native plants were really good for native for fauna, insects, etc. But Doug proves it with his research. He is an entomologist at the University of Delaware. And he found these incredible connections between native plants and native pollinators and other insects, the vast majority of which are beneficial.
So what's the title again? It's
Bringing Nature Home.
Oh, yeah.
By Doug Talamy.
I think maybe, Cheyenne, if we don't have that up on our Facebook page, we can put that up on the a link to that on the Facebook page. That'd be great. We have, oh boy, lots of people who want to visit with you. Kathy and Madison had something relating to an earlier call. Kathy, hi, thank you for calling.
Well, hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to make a comment, I live 2 miles east of the square in Madison, and I bought the property about 12 years ago, and I tried to kill off all the grass. It was just yard and the... it's 30 by 300 feet back to the old bike path. But at one point, I trimmed off too many. I have a lot of blackberries back there, but I had pruned the back at some point, and then the rabbits ate off. they didn't used to eat the blackberries off. They'd always eat off the red raspberries, which I've had trouble with, but they ate off. I pruned them back too far, and the rabbits ate them off. So I had very few blackberries a couple of years ago. So I let them go last year, and now, of course, they're overrunning everything. But I'll be happy to prune them off whenever. But 12 years ago, I didn't use black plastic. I used mainly newspaper and stuff to try to kill off all the grass seed, and it killed off that year's grass. And but there was so much seed that it came back with a vengeance, and I'm always trying to kill off that grass that comes back. There are wildflowers here and there, and I have elderberries and lots of black raspberries, and some I'm trying to encourage red raspberries, and I have them fenced off this year so as to try to fence off the rabbits, right?
So you want to grow, you want to control the raspberries where the wildflowers are, is that correct, Kathy?
Well, that's part of it.
And you have some grass, a grass problem in there too?
Well, I'm more interested in what I could possibly do about the grass.
Well, normally, where did your wildflowers come from? Did you plant them?
Yeah, I got various mixes and this and that.
The various mixes, yes. Yes, the apocryphal various mixes. You want to be careful about your selection. I think this might be the root of your problem. Is that typically a lot of wildflower mixes, what we call commercial wildflower mixes, the magician in a can, like just throw them on the ground and everything will be beautiful. Usually these consist primarily of annuals, biennials, and a few perennials. Whereas a prairie mix consists of primarily perennial native flowers and grasses. And they take longer to establish, but once they're established, they persist.
They take over.
Oh, yeah. They'll outlive the person that plants them if they are properly managed. So what I would suggest you do, if you really want to have a sustainable meadow with lots of flowers in it and some ornamental grasses, probably you want to convert what you've got there into a native prairie, and you'll most certainly have much longer live results, better results, and hopefully lower maintenance. And then the grass, you won't have the problem with the grass that comes back every year because you will have filled the ecological niche occupied by the weedy grasses that come up. You will fill those with perennial prairie grasses that help support the flowers and give you winter interest after all the flowers are done. So I think that that might be the best route for you in that area.
You have quite a bit of information, too, on your website, Neil.
Absolutely. There's a ton of information if you go to the Prairie Nursery website at www.prairienursery.com. And that's P-R-A-I-R-I-E, easily misspelled. I do it all the time. P-R-A-I-R-I-E nursery.com. And we also have a very nice catalog. And you can order a catalog online, or if you want, if you don't have access to the internet or prefer to call and talk to people, you can call our toll-free number at 800-476-9453. And we're there to help people with questions about their native landscapes, too. So feel free to give us a call to get a catalog or just to ask questions about how to do this and what we can do to help you.
And again, that phone number was 800-476-9453?
That's correct. 1-800-GROW-WILD.
All right, there we go. Kathy, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Barbara in Vernon County on Facebook wondered if you have suggestions for bird-friendly natives for gardens in southwest Wisconsin.
Well, bird-friendly natives, that encompasses a lot of territory. That could be trees, it could be shrubs, it could be prairie. And what we recommend, if you're gardening for birds and butterflies, is to have a diversity of all these forms of native plants. Because various birds, in fact, most birds nest in trees and shrubs, not in the prairie. There are some grassland birds, of course, some very important grassland birds like meadowlarks, dick thistles, bobolinks, and a variety of sparrows. But most of your more commonly available birds will nest in trees and shrubs. So you want to make sure you have a mix of all three of these vegetation types, trees, shrubs, and prairie. The prairie flowers bring in oodles and oodles of pollinators and insects and other invertebrates, which form the foundation of the food chain for most birds. That's where they get their protein. So the trees are great for as a home. The prairie is great for your kitchen, for your birds and your butterflies. So, and in the shrubs, there are a lot of shrubs that produce really delectable seeds in the fall. The members of the dogwood family are notable in that regard. The viburnums are not as attractive to birds as a food source, but they are used later in the season when all the other food sources are gone. Then the birds will start to hit on the viburnum seeds. So a combination of a wide variety of native trees, shrubs, prairie flowers, and grasses, I think, is the best way to really create a haven for birds, butterflies, and a wide variety of wildlife.
Ray in Rhinelander has a question for you. Hi, Ray.
Hi. Once again, I thank you, Larry, and your guest for a superb program, very informational. Anyways, I have two interesting things. I'm constantly getting into controversial arguments with people on rose hips and roses. When I used to work for the forestry department, I always found rose hips naturally growing in the middle of nowhere. In the fall, they would have the round pod, and I know they were roses. My question is, are there natural roses that can be reintroduced, and can you take them out of the wild, and are they a native plant? And my second question is, this was really a different one, but burning on the lawn from my dogs when they pee during the spring, summer, and fall, and of course I walk them and everything else, well, it's getting collectively where it's to the point where I'm going to have to dig it up. And that's fine because we're reverting my lawn and area. It's been slowly reverting back. So my question is simply, what to do to prepare the soil for those burn marks? What kind of native grasses can I just put in the wildflower gardens or whatever? Just I want to do something with that, and I'll take the comment off the air. And thank you for all your advice.
Mm-hmm. You bet. Well, let's talk about the roses first. There are three primary roses that occur naturally in Wisconsin prairies and open areas. That's the pasture rose, Rosa carolina, the meadow rose, Rosa blanda, and then the prairie rose, Rosa arkansana. So these are the three primary roses that grow in sunny locations. There's also a few roses that grow in wooded areas as well. I'm not as conversant on those, but these are the three primary roses. There's another rose that occurs south of us called climbing rose, Rosa sativa, which makes a great, great climbing hedge. It's a little tricky when you get up into zone 4. Zone 5 is really its hardiness zone. I grew it for years at the nursery, and then we had a really hard winter in 95, and it killed everything deader than a doornail. last year, it escaped because we had good snow cover. But it's a little tricky when you get into zone 4, which we are. So those are the four main species that most people will plant in Wisconsin for rose. And, of course, the rose hips are great for vitamin C. You don't need to go to the go to the pharmacy and just eat those rose hips. They're a little rough sometimes, and you got to spit out the seeds. That's why most people don't use that method. But as far as converting your lawn into a prairie, that's pretty easily done. Lawns are one of our favorite things because they're usually, if they've been well maintained, they don't have a lot of weeds in them, so it's easy to kill them off. And you can kill them off organically by smothering them for an entire growing season, and then you can scatter the seed in the fall into the dead sod, and it will work its way down into the soil naturally, and you don't have to plow it up or dig it up or till it up. You just scatter the seed like in November. If it's on a slope and you've killed everything off, then you'll want to plant it in September with the prairie seed with a nurse crop like oats or possibly annual rye. That nurse crop will germinate in the fall right away and help to hold the soil over the winter. The prairie seed will then germinate the following spring. These are what you call dormant seedings by seeding the seed in the fall. Another option is to wait until right now. Now is a perfect time for frost seeding. Frost seeding on a prepared site. Everything has to be killed the previous year, so everything is ready to go. Maybe you sprayed it all year with Roundup or herbicide or whatever to kill the lawn, or you smothered it. Those are the two most common ways that people will do this. You can also till it relentlessly, but that's really, really hard work. Been there, done that. Once you get it tilled up and get the sod broken up, but that's a tremendous amount of work, and it uses a lot of fuel. It's kind of a crazy method. It's an old school method we used to use 30, 40 years ago. But you can also do a frost seeding where you scatter the seed right now when the snow, when there's a relatively light snow cover, you'll get the benefit of what we call frost heave in the soil, where it freezes at night and thaws in the day, and the soil opens up and closes up, and your seed, when scattered now, will work its way down into the soil naturally, and then it will germinate in a couple of months when things warm up.
So some pretty good options there, and good question. Thank you. Nick in Presque Isle has a question as well. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. About 13 years ago, we put in a woodland edge. We're in the middle of the woods right next to a lake, and we have about 2,000 square feet of it, and we, of course, ordered the seeds from Prairie Nursery. The thing that happens is that the mix originally came with, I don't know, 18 or so different varieties of seeds in it, plus four grasses. And it seems like over the last bunch of years, it's migrated more into not nearly as many plants. Is there a way to refresh the plants that are there so that we can get more of the varieties? I'm thinking of like echinacea and things like that. It's pretty much all white in the summer, and then it goes yellow in August.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you're probably seeing there is a natural process called ecological succession, where typically you're going to see a peak of flowering activity in year 4, 5, 6. And there's some of the earlier successional perennials, and in some cases biennials, will start to drop out because the longer-lived plants will start to dominate them. Also, you have just a natural selection process of what plants like it better there. Some plants will show up for a while, but some guys will be just a little bit better adapted to it, and they'll take over their territory. Once you've got a well-established planting like that, you have usually a pretty good sod. So scattering seed in there really doesn't do very well because there's a lot of plants already growing, and they're not going to let those seeds in, or the new guys on the block are going to have a really hard time finding a place to grow. So there's two ways you can do this. One is you can go in and dig new areas and put in transplants of the desired species and give them a specific area that you've actually removed the existing vegetation to give them the best chance. Put in a transplant, and I would do this in the spring, late April, May, somewhere in there. Or the other choice is to go in there and really, really mow everything down or burn it off and really rough it up. I mean, go out there, and you could even take a rototiller, just lightly go across it with a tiller, not to the point where you're ripping everything up, but just to scuff the surface of the soil up. Then you can scatter seed in the fall. Fall is the best time to scatter wildflower seed because it will break dormancy in those seeds, and they will germinate better the next spring. So what you're seeing here is just a natural progression of things and probably just a kind of a shakeout of the plants that like your site better, but you can enhance this by these two methods.
There you go.
Okay, because right now the things that we planted are nearly 6 feet tall, and by the time you get to like mid-August.
Yeah, and that's pretty normal with a lot of your native plants. The shorter plants will bloom early, May, June, July, and then when you get in later in the summer, the taller plants, July, August, September, the average height begins to increase as the year goes on. And that's just because the later plants have to get above the earlier plants, and so they've kind of evolved over time to get a little bigger so they can get their shot at the sun.
There you go. Thanks, Nick, for calling.
Good luck, Nick.
Dan in Delafield, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Yeah, you may have just answered my question. Anyway, I work with Prairie Restoration, and it seems that even though we start out with a good mix of wildflowers and grasses over the years, there's fewer flowers and more grasses. Is that something that just happens, or are we doing something wrong?
It's not something that just happens. There's a lot of factors that come into play. I'm gonna summarize this as quickly as I can. First and foremost, the original content of your seed mix is going to determine what your prairie looks like in year 5, in year 10, in year 20, in year 40, in year 50. Well, I've only seen these for 40 years now, so year 40. The original mix will determine pretty much what you're going to have in the future, that balance between flowers and grasses. And what a lot of people do is they put a lot of grass in it because grass seed is usually cheap. Okay, the flower seed is significantly more expensive. So if you're on a budget, you end up with more grass, and then 20 years later, you're wondering, where did all the flowers go? Because the grasses have gotten stronger. Secondly, the timing of planting, of putting the seed in the ground. Fall seedings generally will have a higher percentage of flowers over grasses because a lot of the warm season prairie grasses simply do not germinate well when seeded dormantly in the fall. Something happens to that seed over the winter, and their vitality of those seeds is reduced. So you have lower germination of the prairie grasses, most prairie grasses, the next spring. Spring-seeded prairies, or late spring or early summer-seeded prairies, usually will have a little more grass than flowers, even if I use the exact same mix. I can take the very same mix, put it on the very same soil, side by side, one mix in the fall and one mix in the spring, and they will have totally different characteristics for the rest of their lives.
Wow.
Just because of that timing of seeding and the fall seeding favoring the flowers and the spring or early summer seeding favoring the grasses. Not to the exclusion of the flowers, but you'll have a balance of more grasses than flowers. Finally, prairie management. What a lot of people do is they say, oh, burn prairie every year. Well, burning prairie every year is not necessarily the best thing, especially if you're doing a late mid-spring burning like we talked about earlier in late April, early May. Yes, that's great for disfavoring the cool season grasses and weeds and favoring the warm season prairie plants, but what happens if you do that too often is that you'll push the balance away from the prairie flowers into the prairie grasses, most of which are warm season, and they can become very aggressive, especially big bluestem, switchgrass, and Indian grass. So at my house, I usually will fall seed my prairies to make sure I have lots of good flowers, and I will burn my prairie every other year. Not every year. Yes, and I divide my prairies. I have a number of different prairie plantings. I divide them into management units, and I burn half of those in 1 year, resting the other half so they're not burned. And then the next year, I swap and burn the area. And another reason for that, not only does it help maintain a good balance of flowers to grasses, it also means that I have refugia for my pollinators and other invertebrates in the unburnt area, because a lot of your pollinators and a lot of your insects overwinter as eggs, larvae, sometimes as adults, different forms. So you want to make sure you don't burn everything and wipe out the next generation. So I always make sure I have about half unburned and half burned in any given year, and never burn more than every couple of years. Sometimes I'll go even every third year if I want to make sure and maintain a good balance of flowers to grasses.
And Dan, thank you very much for calling. Neil DeBoll, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you listening in on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking, getting ready for spring native plantings with Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. And always fun talking with him. Join in. Questions or comments about prairies? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Neil, you're involved in a couple of conferences coming up that look really good.
Yeah, the next 2 weeks are looking great. I'll be at a conference called Gardening Northwoods Style on Saturday the 14th, and that's going to be up at the Lac des Flambeaux, Lake of the Torches. And you can get more information, just go to www.gardeningnorthwoodstyle.com. And you can sign up for that. You're going to have Dick Zondag from Junk Seed is going to be there, and he's going to talk about straw bale gardening. I'm going to be talking about native prairie flowers for attracting birds and butterflies. And there's going to be a presenter, Barb Blow, who's going to be talking about, and maybe you can read that, Larry. Their title is fantastic.
Gardening Crimes and Solutions to Prevent an Uprising of the Plant Community.
So I can't wait to see her presentation. So that's Saturday, March 14th. And again, you can learn more at Gardening Northwoods Style. And then on Saturday, March 21st, is the 27th Annual Prairie Enthusiast Conference. And for all you prairie enthusiasts out there, this is a fabulous group. People from, membership is from Wisconsin, Northern Illinois, Eastern Iowa, Eastern Minnesota, and we have an annual conference every year. Our chapter is hosting it. The Central Wisconsin Central Sands chapter is hosting this. And it's going to be in Stevens Point at the Dreyfus Center. And we're going to have a specific focus on pollinators and savanna restoration. One presenter is going to be talking about monitoring your prairie with drones. And there's actually going to be a drone demonstration. So drones can be used for all sorts of good purposes, actually. But the real focus here is going to be on connections. That's the title of the conference because, as Aldo Leopold said, when we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. Excuse me, John Muir said that, not Aldo Leopold. I get those two guys mixed up. Both two great guys from Wisconsin. So connections is a theme, and you can sign up for this. And you can actually look at the list of speakers. You can go to www.theprairieenthusiasts.com, or you can call their office Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, at 608-638-1873, and they can be happy to send you information on registration for this great conference of the Prairie Enthusiasts on Saturday, March 21st at the Dreyfus Center at University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. It looks like it's going to be a great conference.
Yeah.
And we're really looking forward to it.
Lots of great speakers. That is for sure. And, of course, anybody, it's Prairie Enthusiasts sponsored, but anybody is invited for that.
Absolutely. It's open to the public.
Yeah.
You bet.
Well, we have lots of questions for you. Tim in Hancock has something. Tim, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thank you, and it is my pleasure to be able to speak with the two of you. My question is, I am a great observer of the Department of Natural Resources attempts to recreate prairies and restore oak savanna and that kind of thing in the region here, and we are fortunate to have nearby like the Greenwood Wildlife Area, which is a huge prairie restoration, the headwaters of the McCann River. My question for Neil is, part of these restoration attempts and attempts to reestablish areas of oak savanna, the DNR has these properties logged off, and it looks to me like the equipment they use to remove the existing hardwood oak forests and that kind of thing really has some effect on the soils. And but for example, the heavy equipment in these healthy airy, sandy soils does a lot of compaction, that kind of thing. How does that affect the regrowth of native prairie plants, Neil?
Well,
and does it actually promote the growth of invasive species?
Boy, there's a lot of different factors that go into play here, Tim. So I might have to ask you a few questions. First of all, normally, if you're logging, you want to do it in the winter when the soil is frozen to avoid damaging the soil, because frozen soil, you don't damage the plant roots, and generally the compaction is minimal. Unfortunately, last year we had a lot of snow cover, and even though as cold as it was, the ground didn't freeze, so any logging that was done last year, the soil was still subject to compaction or damage. This year, no such problems, because soil is frozen, and it's frozen really well because we had such little snow cover. So it's really important, if you are doing logging, to do it in the winter to minimize damage to the plants. When you say native plants, well, there's all sorts of native plants. There's woodland native plants, there's prairie native plants, all sorts of a whole gamut here. So some disturbances will favor native plants that like disturbed situations. So like raspberries, if you go in and rip around in a woodland, open it up to sun and disturb the soil, you're almost guaranteed to get raspberries. Even if you don't rip up the soil, you're almost guaranteed to get raspberries, at least in that transitional stage. So a lot of different factors come into play, but the most important thing is in our central Wisconsin, former prairie savannas, a lot of times there are native plants underneath those oaks that have been suppressed by shade that once the trees are removed, they will come back.
Come
the prairie
back.
Plants will come back, and especially if you can burn it. That is really, really huge. The problem is sometimes the trees are logged, and then they resprout, and then you get, in 10
yeah.
years, you've got shaded cover again, and so any opportunity for those prairie plants to really reestablish themselves or reassert themselves is lost. So you have a lot of different management conundrums here that have to be dealt with, and when you're dealing with large-scale properties like that, that can be expensive and difficult.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Tim, for calling. Eric in Kenosha, hello to you.
Oh, I'm so excited to be on the air here because this is one of my favorite topics. I have a small woodland garden that I have in my backyard, and I do a lot of traveling around the state, and one of the things that surprises me is so much is the diversity of wildflowers that we have, even what you can just see from the road traveling. And I have a particular one that I'm interested in. It's called... I believe it's called the orange hawkweed. I think in the goatbeard family, kind of looks like a dandelion.
Yeah, Hyraceum aurantiacum, to be precise.
I'm sorry?
Hyraceum aurantiacum.
Okay.
Sorry.
They're absolutely beautiful. And when I get up north to, say, Anago, Langlade County, they're all over the place.
Yes.
And we have a related plant that's yellow down here. And for some reason, and maybe you can help me figure this out, I can't seem to get them to grow.
Well, I can tell you probably exactly why that is, Eric. The red hawkweed, which you're seeing in northern Wisconsin, generally grows in northern Wisconsin and not in southern Wisconsin. And that's for two reasons. Number one, it's more of a cool season plant, cool weather loving plant, so it prefers the cooler summers of northern Wisconsin versus the hotter summers of southern Wisconsin. And you will notice in your travels, the red hawkweed will only generally grow on sandy soil. And I'm going to guess, in Kenosha, you're not sitting on sandy soil unless you're like right by the lake. So do you have a heavy clay soil, which is typical of your area?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So hawkweed is going to really struggle on that. But it can be grown. If you just have a sandy spot and put some sand down, and, I mean, sand, I'm talking like 6 inches to a foot of sand, and take a hunk of that hawkweed, it creeps by rhizomes, and it can be really beyond the point of successful moving towards aggressive. And a very good family friend of mine in Nina loved this plant, and she said, Neil, I want to establish in my back lawn. And I said, be careful. Very careful what you wish for. So she went and dug some clumps up, and this is not a federal crime to go dig up some hawkweed. It's not a native plant anyway. It's actually from Europe. She dug up some clumps and put them in her backyard, and 2 years later she's calling me, how do I get rid of this stuff? It's taking over my lawn.
Can I ask one more quick question?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Many people have been talking about reintroducing, you know, like a wild prairie Wisconsin native plants.
Yeah.
What's the smallest area? I mean, realistically, I think that to be self-stabilizing, you have to have a minimum kind of area. What would you suggest, you know, not so that it would stabilize and be okay by itself?
Well,
with minimum maintenance.
One of the nicest little prairies I ever saw was my friend's shop in Egg Harbor, where she put one butterfly weed at the corner of a parking lot and a sidewalk, and it was this huge butterfly weed, and it was always constantly covered with monarch butterflies and swallowtails. So I would say one good plant is all you need. But if you really want a plant community, we have plant gardens usually with a minimum of like 32 plants, something like that. And it's amazing what you can do, even with a small, diverse prairie with lots of different flowers and a few grasses in it. It's amazing the utilization that you will get. As far as stable plant community, I guess that depends upon what you define as a stable plant community. 50 square feet, 50 acres, somewhere in between those two.
Somebody was wondering if you could eliminate grasses entirely. Just have
a prairie with just flowers?
Yeah.
You can. That's a little tricky because if you look at the root systems of flowers versus the root systems of grasses, grass root systems are dense and fibrous, and it's the grasses that really help to squeeze out the weeds. And a lot of your flowers that are tap-rooted, it's hopeless. They're going to have weeds all around those taproots because they're not occupying the surface soil. And the open surface soil is where your weeds grow. So the grasses are really your enforcers against the weeds. There are there are a lot of fibrous-rooted flowers, prairie flowers, that you can plant, and you can get close to a all-flower prairie, but it's tricky, and you are always going to be subject to invasion by undesirable grasses and weeds, so it's really tough to do it.
Marianne and Hurdle, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. My question is about milkweed. I've seen different information out there about the monarch butterflies. So we decided we wanted to plant more milkweed, and all of the nurseries in the area look at me like I'm crazy. So we wanted to get seeds so that this spring we would just have this abundance of milkweed and therefore monarch butterflies. So I'm just wondering if you can give us some help in this area, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah, as I was mentioning earlier today, when I first started growing native plants 33 years ago, every single plant I grew was considered a weed. And honestly, one of the plants, and now people accept them in their gardens, and all these wonderful native prairie plants are wonderful. One plant that has really only recently been accepted is the common milkweed. And even gardeners who embrace all the coneflowers and the blazing stars and the joe pie weeds and even the sneeze weed, they've resisted the common milkweed because it creeps by rhizomes, and it's considered a weed in a farm field. But now, because that is such an important plant for the monarch butterfly caterpillars, it's even being accepted into gardens. And so if you would like to, we do sell seeds of a variety of different species of milkweed. We have milkweed gardens and milkweed seed mixes. Monarch gardens and monarch seed mixes with a variety of milkweed seeds and plants in them. So, you know, you can just give us a call at our 800 number and or go on our website at prairienursery.com and find out more. The 800 number is 800-476-9453, and you can call now and someone will help you.
There you go, 1-800-476-9453. Boy, it's always fun talking about native plants with Neil DeBole. Neil is president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. He's been doing this for 33 years. He's had his company, but his international reputation, and it's always great to have him with us for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. So happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Native plants add a lot of beauty and interest to a landscape, and besides that, they create a healthy habitat for all kinds of wildlife. Larry Mueller here, glad you could join us for Garden Talk. Neil DeBole, my guest from Prairie Nursery, knows a lot about native and woodland plants and grasses. Always had great advice to share. And Neil, thank you so much for coming by.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. We've had some questions, and I wanted to bring this up. Some folks have been wondering about moving plants or dividing plants. You've got various types, grasses and taproot plants and so forth. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure, absolutely. As spring comes, we think about, we got to maybe divide this plant, or maybe I want some more of these over here, or I think this plant will look better over there. General rule of thumb, whenever you are moving or dividing plants, is to do it while they're dormant. That is the safest method with almost every species. So our two opportunities for doing this are either in the late fall, or in the early spring before the plants come out of the ground. If you're going to do spring divisions or spring moving of plants, it's always wise to flag them in the fall so you can find them in the spring. Now, grasses generally have some telltale remnant vegetation so you can find them the next year. But a lot of your flowers, the stems fall down or the leaves just kind of melt away. And then you're going, wow, where is that? I wanted to divide that this spring, but I don't remember where that is. So it's always good to take one of those little flags and mark that plant and put the name on it or a code or something like that so you can find it in the spring. So some plants are not divisible. If you look at particularly some of your tap-rooted prairie flowers like compass plant, butterfly weed, the wild indigos, there's cream wild indigo or cream false indigo, the white and the blue, these have tap roots and they are very tricky to divide or impossible to divide. So just once you always put them where you want them, because once they become mature, you're going to need a backhoe to get them out of there. And you'll probably kill them in the process of moving them, unless you can get like literally 3 or 4 feet of the root. Most people are not going to dig 4 feet down to get their plant. But the grasses are no-brainers to divide. Most grasses are clump formers or sod formers, where you can get a big hunk of it and divide it. A few grasses are rhizomatous and they creep by runners. You've got to get enough of that runner, usually 6 to 12 inches, to get a new plant from that. A lot of times, the grasses are generally best divided in the spring, but I divide them in the fall too, with very good results, as long as they have gone dormant for the year and I'm not disturbing any of their leaves or while they're actively growing.
Mm-hmm.
Spring flowers, early blooming spring flowers, are best divided in the fall. In fact, some of them go dormant in August, and you can divide them right after they go dormant, August, September, into October. Things like trilliums, although trilliums are a little tough to divide depending on the species, some are dividable and some are not. So you want to know the species. Like our native white trillium, it's harder to divide. Easy to transplant, but it doesn't make little offshoots. Whereas our prairie trillium, which has a red flower, easy and breezy to divide, and you get lots of little babies off of it after 5 or 6 years. So most of your woodland wildflowers are easier and best divided in the fall, because then they're pre-positioned for blooming the next spring very early.
There we go.
So spring for most of your prairie plants, fall for your woodland plants, and a lot of your prairie plants also will divide quite well in the fall.
Rob in Hales Corners has a question or comment. Rob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Neil. I have one comment and two questions.
Okay.
About 30 years ago, we planted a road embankment in the prairie, and it took about 5 years to take off, and we had a good mix of grass and forbs for about 10 years. We used to be able to burn, and now we can't. Now it's almost all forbs, about 3 dominant forbs. And I only found one clump of big blue stem this fall, which is really interesting to me. My first question is, do Prairie Dock and Compass Plant hybridize?
Yes, Compass Plant and Prairie Dock do hybridize, and so do Rosin Weed and Prairie Dock. I have rosin weed and compass plant. I have a rosin weed compass plant hybrid at my house. And
yes, I found some compass plant hybrids where the leaves were the usual form and texture.
Yes.
And the flower stem was completely smooth.
Yep.
And the seeds looked very different from normal compass
very
plant
cool.
seeds.
Yep. And the leaves will be kind of intermediate between the two generally. Is that correct, what you're seeing?
Yeah, they probably were less hairy.
Yeah. So
okay, and yeah. One of the dominant forbs has become cup plant.
Oh, yes.
Aggressive.
Yes.
And do you have any suggestions about how to maybe knock that back?
Wow. Cup plant, which is related to your compass plant, prairie dock, and rosin weed, can be extremely aggressive. And let me guess, you're probably on a heavy clay soil. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah, it loves clay. It normally it grows in semi-shaded riparian woodlands, but it adapts itself perfectly to heavy clay soils or damp soils in full sun. And
it
self-sows rapaciously. Birds love it. It's one of the best plants you can plant for birds, because it provides them water in the cups of the leaves and seeds in the fall, and also insects that they will eat from the flowers. But boy, oh boy, that thing can get out of control. You put it on dry sandy soil, it'll get 4 feet tall and hardly spread. You put it on clay soil, it'll get 12 feet tall and creep all over the place. Well, it'll spread by seed all over the place. It doesn't actually creep. Controlling that, oh man. you people can whack it and whack it and whack it. You can spray it, and you know, you have to spray it repeated times with Roundup in order to kill that stuff. It is one tough customer. So generally, you want to use a small quantity of it, but sometimes just a small quantity is all it takes for it to get established and really go crazy. And it is case by case, but it does.
Would a cut stem application of Roundup do any good?
Some of our customers have done that. It's moderate in its effectiveness. I would do it late in the season, around August, when it's blooming, August, September, and see if that won't give you some results. But a lot of times, if it gets really out of control, you may have to resort to the nuclear option
and basically
blast everything and start over. But the cup plant is one of the most aggressive of our native prairie plants.
Mm. I'll agree with your comment about the birds. We had hordes of goldfinches just mobbing these things last fall. Yeah. It was very interesting.
Yeah, it's a fantastic plant for that. But on this report card, it occasionally will say does not play well with others. And definitely your school is a perfect example of that.
Well, you've answered questions from some other people, too. There were others who were wondering about cup plants and how to keep them in check. And so Not the easiest thing in the world. Kevin in Rock County, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. I guess I have a comment, too. It's about biodiversity and maintaining it in the prairie through the summer.
Yeah.
And I've been doing this a few years down in Illinois, now up in Wisconsin. And we have about 44 acres. And the idea is I planted a whole bunch of acreage, just a big blue stem, just so I could turn it into a hay crop. And the idea is you harvest it first week of July when it starts to boot. But what you can also do is use that harvesting time as your control start time for your warm season grasses. Excuse me. Big blue stem's the first to bolt, then switch, then Indian. And the idea is you go and you harvest them with your string trimmer or your mowing deck or your riding mower. And if you can, you pick up the material and you either use it, I'll say, creatively to smother what you don't want. But the idea is you re-daylight the area, and your forbs come back in. And they come back in gangbusters. I have areas where now I've got, used to be all tall grass, now it's aster and goldenrod, and it looks natural. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Kevin,
yeah.
You're absolutely right. In fact, the most floriferous prairies in the United States are in western and southern Missouri. And these are prairies on rock that could never be plowed. And so the settlers and present-day farmers have hayed them. Mm-hmm. And they mow them exactly as you're saying. They're mowing them for optimizing grass production, usually in mid to late July, usually because they get a little more production at that time of year. So they have prairies that are full of flowers, except for midsummer flowers. They get fantastic early spring into mid-spring flowers, but then everything gets cut down, so a lot of the midsummer plants don't bloom or can't produce seeds. But then the asters and goldenrods regrow after being mowed in July, after the hay has been removed. And so you get this kind of really great spring and really great fall flower display with the summer kind of compressed for the flowers. But it is amazing. For 150 years, people have been mowing these prairies in Missouri, and they are absolutely more floriferous than any of these protected prairies where, oh, we can't mow it, we can't cut it, we can't do anything on it, we can't walk on it. Well, guess what? The bison and the elk munch the bejesus out of these things.
Yeah.
So what they're doing is kind of sort of replicating that, and you're absolutely right. It will lead to a much higher forb-to-grass ratio over time.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, thank you.
Oh, okay, but I've got one more thing, if I may.
All right.
Okay, it's the idea with prescribed burning. I've been doing some research, and the idea is they, back in the 70s, they did a study to control sweet clover by starting to burn late summer.
Yes.
So August, September.
Actually,
it works very well.
Wow, that's really good. August, now the studies I saw in the early 70s were burning in June to kill the adults and the newly germinated species. And this was in the proceedings of, I believe, the third North American Prairie Conference. That's very interesting. So they're blooming in August
and
September.
More seed production.
Really? But see, the seeds would have been produced by August or September. So how would that have...
I'm sorry. Native seed production... but then when you find that next year's yearlings growing up,
yeah,
and I cook them with my I'll wait till the rains start, and I go out with my roofing torch, and I can do a small area in between all these native stands. It doesn't spread. It's very precise. I'll send you an email on it.
That would be great. I'd be very interested to see that.
Yeah, thank you very much, Kevin, for calling. I appreciate your call. Interesting. Well, Bob in Eau Claire has a question. Thank you for calling, Bob.
You're welcome, and thank you. Two of my favorite people are on the air right now, and I'm not one of them.
Oh, man.
We live in just south of Eau Claire in a very sandy area, and we bought a house that we're in now going on 8 years. And it's got a drain field. And I was listening to your comments earlier about doing a prairie on a mound. Would that also work on a drain field area? Now, the one complication is the previous owners, and we love this fact, in fact, they planted evergreens around the perimeter of the entire property, and the property is an acre, so there are a lot of evergreens around us. And I know that the best thing to do for a prairie is to burn it every once in a while. But with all the evergreens around, that would make me a little nervous about, you know, having an open flame going on there.
Let me ask you a couple questions. I'm sorry.
Please. Go ahead.
First of all, how far are the evergreens from your septic mound that could possibly be planted to prairie?
They're cheek by jowl.
Cheek by jowl. Okay, you're talking like right next to it.
Right next to it.
Okay,
right.
And would you then have less than a half a day of full sun on this septic mound?
Oh, no. We would have three quarters of a day of sun because the line of evergreens against which the drain field sits, you know, runs north south.
Okay, and are these pines or spruces?
They are a mix of pines and spruces.
Okay, so you have some low hanging spruce boughs that could be damaged by fire, probably, right?
Yeah.
And most of the
now
pine.
What we intend to do is I intend to prune a lot of the lower branches and get some of those up off the ground.
Okay, then you're golden. Let me tell you what to do. You ready?
Yep.
Prune those branches up so they're above your head, about 8 feet up. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That will remove the low-hanging branches that could possibly catch fire. Then, does your septic system, is there topsoil on it, or is it still the original sand backfill?
Well, I'm sure it's got some topsoil, and it's got a luxurious lawn growing on it right now.
Okay, then it sounds to me as though you probably have a good layer of topsoil on top of that. We do have a septic field mix specifically designed for dry, sandy backfill, but because there's topsoil on that, you're probably going to want to use like a low-growing or a short prairie mix for medium soil.
Okay.
Because of that topsoil. Then, when that prairie matures and you're ready to burn it, which is usually the spring of the third year, is usually when we have sufficient grass, what we call fine fuel, to carry a fire, usually the third spring, then what you would do is before you burn it, take a weed whacker and whack everything down to the ground.
Hmm.
Now, what that does is that reduces the height of the fuel and it changes the whole dynamics of the air-to-fuel ratio, and you'll have a boring, completely controllable, slow-moving fire that you can... There's no way it's going to hurt anything because it's just going to creep along the ground. I'd be surprised if you got flames more than a foot tall. If you leave it standing, you can have flames 6 to 10 feet tall.
Oh.
If you cut it down, 1, maybe 2 feet tall. So that's how you can control the intensity and the height of a fire by just cutting everything down just before you burn. Don't cut it down to fall before because it'll turn to a mushy mass of nothing burnable. You cut it down just before you want to burn, and you have all that nice dry flammable material, and it just creeps along the ground. And in fact, if you go to our website, I have some publications. One is called How to Burn Your Prairie Safely and Have Fun Too. And this is one of many, many tips on how to burn. And also, I would suggest that you have a strip of lawn. If you don't already, maintain a strip of lawn between your trees and your prairie, because that's your fire break. And then get your hose out and hose that down before you start, and you're ready to go.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. That's great advice for a lot of people,
it really
I'm
works.
Pretty sure.
Yep.
We had a Facebook question from Cheryl who wonders, if you don't burn every year, what do you do? Is there anything else you need to do to the prairie in the off years?
That's a really great question. If you're, say, for instance, you're doing like I do at my house, where I divide my prairie into two halves, burn one half 1 year and rest the other, and then the next year I burn the unburned half that was from the previous year, it doesn't look so great in the spring because you have all that dead standing material. So for the people that want a more clean look to their prairie, they will go out and just whack everything down in the spring. I don't. Okay, mm-hmm. Because number one, I live in the country. I don't care what the heck my neighbors think. And even if I didn't live in the country, I wouldn't care what the heck my neighbors think, but that's another issue altogether. So what I do is I leave my prairie that I don't burn that year standing because there are certain birds that will use the cover remaining in the spring for foraging. There might be insects in there that they can get to. On a larger area, if you have grassland nesting birds, there are some birds that prefer the dead standing material for nesting,
mm-hmm.
and there are other birds that prefer the new growth after the burn. So I have two totally different habitat types. One, the burned half with the new growth, and the unburned half with all the dead standing material. So I actually am optimizing my ecological diversity by leaving the dead material stand. But it doesn't start to look good until sometime usually in May when the plants get up and start to cover up all the old debris from the previous
yeah,
year.
Yeah, but you know what? I kind of like the old debris look, too.
I do, too. Larry, you and I are just old debris lookers here.
It's true. I think I like the look of it.
I love CSI botany when you have to go tell the plants by their dental records. You know, that's really, really fun. So, but if you want to have a little more cleaner look, what some people will do is they will just mow it down to 6 inches or something like that.
Chris in Lake Tomahawk, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi, Larry and Neil. Thank you. I have another silphium dilemma here, and the area in question is in Waukesha County, actually. But 7 or 8 years ago, I planted a row of prairie dock on the border of a vegetable garden and a prairie garden. The prairie dock have now since multiplied and grown into monsters, just huge dozens of leaves, to the point where they, I now have to channel the bison and cut most of the leaves off once a year because they're smothering out the nearby other good plants.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't want to kill them or dig them up if I can avoid it.
Sure.
But it seems like even severe pruning is not making much of a dent in them. And I'm just, you know, wondering if there are any, things to do that might tame them into a more normal size.
Okay. Well, Chris, are these plants spreading by seed, or are they just in the row where you planted them?
Well, yeah, they have reproduced by seed.
Yeah, a little here and there, right? Not everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't get crazy like cup plant. The compass plant and the prairie dock, which are relatives with the cup plant, do not go insane by seed like the cup plant can. However, the prairie dock, you probably have leaves that are 3 feet tall and look like big elephant ears, right?
They're massive.
Yeah, which is why I love that prairie dock plant. But if it's in your way, a prairie dock has a huge, huge root, and you can abuse that plant with a mower, and it'll just say, ha, trying to tickle me or what? So what you can do is you can go in. When those leaves get really big, just go in. Just mow them right to the ground.
Yeah.
And they will come back, and usually a little bit smaller. I don't know. Have you already tried that?
Well, yeah, I do that about once a year in June. Okay. So maybe I need to be a little bit more aggressive and go in there a few times a year.
Oh, yeah. You could do it 2 or 3 times probably and not really harm the plant.
Okay.
Now, it may affect your... It may
have down into, like, you know, what you might see in a remnant prairie where you maybe only have, like, 1 to 3 leaves?
No, because, see, in a remnant prairie, it's in competition with all the other plants around it.
Yeah.
Because you have these in rows and probably what's around it, like lawn or something like that?
Well, no, it's a planted prairie also.
Planted prairie.
Okay. I'm thinking there's probably some inputs of, you know, fertilizer trip coming in from the vegetable garden.
Sure, you could have that factor, too. Yeah. and I'm guessing you don't have a lot of tall prairie grasses competing with it, or is that not the case?
Yeah, not yet. No, the Forbes took over kind of early.
Okay, and that when you're looking at that prairie dock in a prairie remnant, it's usually surrounded by big blue stem or Indian grass or switchgrass, which are competing with it for nutrients and water. So in lieu of that competition, the prairie dock has pretty much everything it wants, and it's going to get big and huge, and it's going to thank you so much, Chris.
Oh, man. All right.
So I would go out there. I would whack it a couple times and see if that doesn't help. If you whack it too late, then you're not going to get blooms out of it. So usually if you mow prairie dock after August 15th, it's probably not going to bloom, or at least it might bloom but may not be able to produce viable seeds, which in your case might be a positive because you don't want any more of it.
Yeah, well, that's something to think about anyway, Chris. thank you so much for calling. You guys have wild rice? Wild rice is not out.
No, wild rice is getting harder and harder to find. People will purchase it to establish around ponds. And actually, it's really not a good pond plant. Wild rice needs clean running water.
Yeah.
And it needs a mucky, thick bottom. And how mucky should that be? Really mucky, because a buddy and I went out once a million years ago, 102 degrees on September 2nd, and the canoe got stuck in the muck, and I got out to push it. And he had the regulation 36-inch stick or whatever it was to beat the wild rice into the canoe. And I was in muck up to my neck, and I got out of the river, and I had about 300 leeches on me. Which was totally cool. I thought, wow. So I just got out my pocket knife and scraped them off. But it needs, I mean, that was just a thick, black, oozy muck, and it was very, very clean, central Wisconsin, sandy stream water. So,
stream water.
But as far as where to get wild rice, there used to be places that sold it in Wisconsin, but it's harder to find because it's hard to handle because it can't dry out.
Prairie Enthusiasts Annual Conference, again, Saturday, March 21st in Stevens Point at the Dreyfus Center. And we've got, I'm sure we have a link to that now up on our Facebook page. Neil, thank you so much.
Larry, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Always a great pleasure. Neil DeBull, Prairie Nursery President in Westfield, Wisconsin. And he'll be back again. And he's he'll be certainly at that Prairie Enthusiast Conference. So looking forward to having you stay with us here on the Ideas Network.